I got quiet all of a sudden.
That's like a library.
Good afternoon. Good Friday afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Thank you all for choosing to spend your afternoon with us instead of outside in the nice weather. We're going to talk about important things today, and we appreciate your participation. I'm going to start with opening work session on House Bill 2963 and explain that we've had some conversations with the Speaker's office. This bill, while it certainly has some relevance for this committee, is probably more appropriately taken up in the Judiciary Committee. They've had some conversations about it before the session, and we've received approval to send that over to the Judiciary Committee where they expect it. With that, Representative Benz.
Mr. Chairman, per the Speaker's approval and direction, I move that the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development refer House Bill 2963 to the House Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved that our committee refer House Bill 2963 to the House Committee on Judiciary, and I would just say for clarification, we are doing so without recommendation so that they might consider it. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objections to the motion? I don't see any. The motion carries. House Bill 2963 is referred to the House Committee on Judiciary. Close the work session on House Bill 2963 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2657. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2657 establishes requirements to be met by applicant before local government can consider application to rezone industrial use land that is planned and zoned for industrial use and include advertise availability of the land to potential industrial developer, prove changed circumstances of reduced value or utility of the land, and solicit officers to purchase the land from potential purchasers with the ability to hold or improve the land in anticipation of industrial development and use.
Thank you. We have two people signed up to testify, Alana Guinea and Caleb Hayes. And while you two are coming forward, a note for the committee's benefit, you'll see on our agenda that this bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Land Use. So depending on what we hear and decide to do, our next step would be to send the bill to the Land Use Committee.
Correct.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. And I am sorry that your colleague, Representative Doherty, isn't here. I know that as the sponsor of the bill, she was hoping to be able to speak to it. Hopefully I can speak for a long enough period of time that she gets here. Still keeping it quick. you know, there have been many discussions in the Land Use Committee, and I know there have been many here already, and you'll have more today about the value of industrial land for our economies, both locally and at the state level. And I think everybody agrees that we need to have a strong industrial land base.
Alana, I'm afraid we need to ask you to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. I thought I did that. Alana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO for the record. I apologize.
No problem.
We all agree that we need to have a strong industrial land base. There are a few different ways that we can try to achieve a strong land base. And what this tries to do is ensure that we don't lose the land that we already have zoned industrial. No matter where you commute from on your way to Salem, I would guess that you pass areas that either were once zoned industrial and were rezoned at some point and turned into either a large-scale commercial or residential development, or you pass land that is currently zoned industrial that hasn't been developed, and the landowner may be trying to find an industrial developer. They may be trying to rezone it to another use. Either way, along our main arteries, we need to keep as much of that land as is useful zoned industrial while still allowing landowners and communities to develop in other ways where land is no longer of industrial use. And that's exactly what this bill tries to get at. It sets up criteria to ensure that we are not rezoning land prematurely when it could still be of industrial use to our communities, to businesses in our state, and to the people who work at those businesses, while still allowing local processes to proceed as makes most sense within the local jurisdiction. We were very careful when we looked at how to write this bill to make sure that it would add these criteria to what our local jurisdictions looked at, but that it would not override any flexibility that a local jurisdiction had, limit anything that a local jurisdiction should do, or otherwise get in the way of these processes that are already in place. And it says that where these criteria have been met and there's not a good industrial use, a landowner should rezone that land and should create something of value to themselves and the community. Where it is still of industrial use, though, we need to make that a priority for our communities and our state. To give you an idea of rezoning of industrial land, within the last 10 years, over 25 pieces of land that were over 25 acres, most of them significantly larger than that, have been approved for rezoning across the state. I'm not sure how many were not approved. Those numbers are harder to find, but those ones have been approved. That included, within the last 5 years, 148-acre parcel, 157-acre parcel. These are large pieces of land, and perhaps those were the right decision for our local bodies to have made. Perhaps that made sense, but we believe that we need to just take an extra look at these areas and make sure that it was the right decision. There are a few places where our local governments, the League of Cities, a few individual cities have asked if we can tighten up the language. I'm currently working with those bodies on an amendment that would change just a few words to ensure that the bill works the way that it's intended for those local jurisdictions. I will have that amendment for you hopefully next week. So whenever you are able to get this back on the schedule, we'll have it. I apologize that we don't have it today. Some of those concerns we just found out about recently. But we are working with them to make sure that this is a bill that is agreeable to everybody and that is implemented the way we think it should be.
Very good. Mr. Hayes.
Members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Trades Council. We represent approximately 25,000 highly skilled construction workers. It is an absolute pleasure to be here on a Friday afternoon. So first, I'd like to thank you for holding this hearing on this important bill, and I'd also like to thank you for working on this issue. I know this committee's taken up the topic of industrial lands for years now, and we appreciate it because it's incredibly important to our state's economy. I'd like to echo the sentiment of Ilana here, and you know, we agree and we support the bill. In the past two decades, one-third of all metro area industrial land has been converted to other uses. This is unfortunate in our view because these industrial lands attract traded sector employers that produce high-paying jobs. Studies show that further development in the metro area on these industrial lands could net the state 12,500 jobs. These are really good jobs. The average salary on those jobs would be about $97,000 a year. These type of jobs that we see created on industrial lands contribute heavily to our state's income tax revenues, which go to support good schools and public services. Protecting our industrial lands is key to our state's economic viability in the long term. The governor, the Oregon Business Plan, and I'm sure everyone here in this room agrees that we need to raise our state's median income. Protecting industrial lands is key to doing that. We urge you to support the bill with the friendly amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty, this is your bill. We started before you got here. Is there anything you'd like to add to the conversation?
No, just a part of this is the area that I represent, the Tigard area. And in my other hat locally, I'm on the Tigard Planning Commission. And we're always kind of struggling with being a community that's landlocked, making sure that the industrial lands that we have, not only zoned industrial, but the space that we have for industrial is maintained. Being in a community that's very, very close to transportation, the I-5 corridor, and having a lot of light and some heavy industrial that we have in our area now, it's just another one of those steps to make sure that we have enough industrial land to create the jobs, because that's the one thing that communities want to do in the planning sense, is you want to not have the people live over here and commute to the job, but live in the community and where the job is. And so we want to make sure that the lands are preserved for what they were initially intended to do. So.
Thank you. Representative Lively, then Representative.
Mr. Chair, I wholeheartedly support the concept, and we've had this conversation, and my issue is always one of local control, and local governments are the ones that have the ability to make the decisions. So as long as what this ends up being is the onus is on the applicant and the local governments still make the final decision, I'm certainly comfortable with that.
Thank you. Representative Corson.
So, and either one of you can answer this, this isn't a bill that would just relate to greenfield sites. In other words, if you think of the Northwest Industrial Area in Portland near the Fremont Bridge, we've seen some transitions where we had terminal facilities and industrial locations that have gone away and then replaced by upscale housing. Would it apply to that sort of issue too?
Presumably, it would apply to that. Whether or not under this policy, those changes still would have been made would really depend on what's going on the ground, if there were industrial developers interested in the land or not, and I couldn't tell you if there would have been, but it would have applied to that area before it was rezoned.
So correct. Greenfield, brownfield, doesn't matter?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Chair. Could you talk about the process you see occurring? We've talked about the intent, but I'd like to talk about the bill itself and what it does.
Absolutely. So before an application to rezone land was approved, the local jurisdiction would look at three things on top of whatever their local process is. They would ask the landowner to have, and presumably the landowner would have done this before they apply to rezone their land, to advertise the property for sale in publications where an industrial developer would be looking. So in trade publications through Business Oregon, there are a few examples of the type of places where one might advertise laid out in the bill. The landowner would offer the land for purchase to what we often call patient landowners, people who will hold on to that property, improve that property. In a down economy, sometimes there are not people looking to immediately create an industrial development on land, but who are looking to hold on to property for when the economy rebounds, because that land still is of industrial value and we want to make sure that we keep that in industrial reserves. And then the landowner also would show the local jurisdiction how that land was no longer of the same industrial use that it was. So perhaps there's residential development right next door to that land where now there are restrictions on noise or on hours that you could run a factory, something like that, or perhaps there's not the same access through trucks and other forms of transportation that you would need to that land. So it really doesn't hold the same industrial use or value that it had when it was zoned. Once those three conditions were met, whatever the normal local process is, conditions have been met, then the rezoning would happen. If anything within the existing local process went wrong, if these three conditions couldn't be met, then the land would not be rezoned.
Follow up.
Please.
Concerned with lines 18 and 19, the third requirement, and the bill says the applicant has solicited offers to purchase the land from potential purchasers. And here's the scenario that I'm envisioning. Mm-hmm. If this land zoned industrial is within an area that is no longer industrial, how would they ever have solicited an offer from a potential purchaser for industrial uses? You see the conundrum that puts that landowner in?
They could solicit offers and not receive any.
Well, it's follow-up. Sorry.
Please.
It says, has solicited offers to purchase the land from potential purchasers.
It may be that we need to change that from as we're looking at the other amendments, because the intent there, and I apologize if it wasn't drafted that way, is that they have gone out and seeked somebody who would be interested in the land, and were there no one interested in the land, they, of course, would move forward with rezoning it.
Follow up.
Please.
Thanks. I guess I see Section 3 as duplicitous, duplicative, excuse me.
Friday afternoon, it's fine.
Maybe it is duplicitous, who knows?
As long as we're being clear.
Of Section 1, the intent being you have advertised this land for industrial purposes. Section 3 says, in my mind, no, you really have to mean it. And as I'm seeing the interpretation, it is, so am I going to send a letter of intent to random people that they maybe think about purchasing my land?
Section 1 looks at an industrial developer where you would still own the land and find somebody interested in developing that land for an industrial purpose. Section 3 looks at somebody who would hold on to the land, possibly improve the land, for development later. So again, Section 3 was thinking specifically about economic downturns, other times when there are not industrial developments going up, but looking at land that is still of industrial value and that we'd like to keep as industrial land until the economy rebounds, and ensuring that we are looking to people who might be interested in holding that land until that time. Whereas Section 1, again, is looking specifically at somebody who would be interested in developing the land now.
Thank you. Follow-up. Switching to Section 2. Thank you for that response. I would not agree that that is the effect of this. I think the effect still of the language in the statute is to require a solicitation of an offer to a potential purchaser, which is a very high bar. Section 2, lines 15 through 17, my question would be, what are the standards for showing change circumstances?
Chair Reed, Representative Davis, we specifically left that language loose so that we were not infringing on local jurisdiction.
Follow.
Go ahead.
The problem I see is, as anybody who dabbles in the area of land use knows, leaving something loose also leaves it ripe for litigation. I suppose that's a rhetorical question.
Or a comment. Or was it even a question?
Maybe it was duplicitous.
You attorneys like that.
Chair Reed, would you mind if I respond
no,
to the
please do.
Duplicitous
Thank
question? In the conversations that I have had, Chair Reed, Representative Davis, with various local jurisdictions, they have not expressed discomfort with that specific issue. However, if there is discomfort with that issue,
he was first.
I don't have a problem setting standards in there. I again left that loose so that we were allowing local jurisdictions around the state to apply the standards that they currently have as much as possible. But if there is an interest in tightening that up, I'd be happy to look at language that would do so.
Thank you.
Very good.
Okay.
Representative Doherty?
Well, this is more just kind of a comment with, to Representative Davis's concern over the land use and making it, you know, a little loose. I mean, anybody that deals with city planning, urban planning, any of these kind of things knows that you have to follow the state land use regulations first. And, I mean, we've all seen, if you've ever been to a planning commission meeting or any sort of hearing like this, the copious notes that have been taken and the material that they have related to the land use laws. But yet on the other hand, the land use areas leave it up to the local community to go through and plan around their planning areas. I mean, we've got comprehensive plans that deal with this that have to go through and jive with the state comprehensive plans. But in my experience of dealing with either the developments or coming in with, in our case in Tigard Light Industrial, is that we do have certain codes and certain standards, and for our community, and our community is the one that knows what fits into the different areas. And so, you know, yes, you've got land use law over here, and cities, the very last thing they want to do is have any land use litigation, but there is that openness that they can use their own policies in the jurisdictions to go through and zone it the way that the city deems the best while still following land use laws. So there is some leverage.
Representative Cameron, then Representative Benz.
Thank you. Thanks for being here on a beautiful Friday afternoon. It is gorgeous out there. You mentioned in your opening testimony some examples of acreage that's been converted. Do you have any specific geographic areas, and we can talk about the process they went through to convert that and why they converted it?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, unfortunately, when you request from our state agencies areas of land that have been converted, they give you a code for the city name, some of which are discernible, some are not, and an acreage amount and what it was converted to, and no other information. So I don't. I apologize for that.
And then follow up, if I may. Thank you. And I just, it's probably more of a statement, and I heard Representative Duarte mention that it's important that the local control is maintained, and this just puts another layer over local control. They obviously have reasons why they want to do things and what their community wants to look like, and the more things like this that we open up for litigation and challenges in an already complicated system is maybe not the best way to encourage people to maintain. There's probably other ways we can find to have them encouraged to develop businesses and have businesses come. I think we're going to hear a couple of those later on today as well. But I just want to make sure that we're not adding another layer from the state over the local cities and counties that are making these decisions for various reasons. And that's why I'd like to have some examples of where those conversions have been made and what was their reasons and the processes they actually went through and how this would relate to those.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Yeah.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for statutory intent purposes, perhaps you could share with us who a purchaser with the ability to hold or improve land in anticipation of development might be. We all have something in our mind, but tell us what you're thinking.
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, I think that that would look different in different areas of the state. In some areas of the state, there are local jurisdictions who have a history of holding land. In some areas of the state, there are industrial developers who have a history of purchasing and holding land for a long period of time. I could imagine some sort of land trust at some point that would be interested in industrial land, although no such thing exists in Oregon at this time. I think there are a lot of different ways that that body could look.
Well, as everyone's concerned about whatever standard it is this establishes that somebody has to then meet, so the solicitation of the offers, what that means to me is that I would send someone a letter saying, I have a piece of property and I know you have money. I would sell this to you for $10 million, knowing full well it's worth $500,000. And now I've solicited the offer, I've sent the letter, I've asked, and the person who I send it to may have $10 million, but the property may be worth $500,000. Is that what you have in mind when we talk about solicitation of an offer?
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, it is not the intent, and what we have in mind is that any interested party would be looking at paying the value of the land for that land, not something I think that was four times more expensive for it.
Thank you. The issue here, of course, is the nature of the solicitation and proving then that there was indeed a solicitation, a reasonable one or what, and that would suggest that whoever comes before the Planning Commission would have to have with them an appraisal that they would have to pay for, and they would have to have that number in the solicitation letter. That's what you're saying would have to occur for them to prove that indeed there had been a real solicitation.
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, again, my intention is to leave this language as broad as makes sense. If members of the committee would be more comfortable if the word solicitation were addressed, if fair market value were inserted, I think we could look at doing that. I would not want to insert fair market value and then put another burden on anybody involved in this process. But I think that we could look at ways of doing that that would not require you to bring somebody, an assessor, with you to the meeting.
Good. Well, yeah, my concern about this is let's assume that the property for residential purposes is worth $10 million. For industrial, it's worth $500,000. Mm-hmm. So when we have it appraised, the person that wants to sell it wouldn't be enthusiastic about having it appraised for that purpose. The issue is what is its highest and best use. So the concern is, does that sentence create kind of a right of first refusal held by those who would use it for a certain purpose? That's a chilling effect on the saleability of the property. So when I look at this, I see a right of first refusal in the form of the third section. You generally support those because they tend to pervert outcomes when it comes to market use of property, which of course is all land use planning. But I would say that needs some work, that section. Whether we do it in this committee or in the land use committee is up to the committee. Another question.
Right. Okay. I have a question, and I apologize for asking you to repeat something you already said. As I ask it, I will note for the rest of the committee, there is some testimony in OLIS from 1,000 Friends of Oregon. When you were describing the fact that you have some amendments forthcoming, I was in the process of opening that up, and they also have what I would characterize as a sort of a soft suggestion for something they'd like to add to the bill. And I think as I was looking for that, I missed your description of what amendments you have forthcoming. So could you please repeat that?
Chair Reed, I didn't go into the specifics of them, but there are a few places where local jurisdictions have asked for individual words to be changed okay. or removed, which they feel would tighten the language. I don't want to describe on the record on their behalf exactly how they're hoping to change it.
That's fine. Even that general description helps me. I'd missed that previously. That's helpful. Okay. Anything else from the committee? Okay. And I don't think we have anybody else who's signed up for this bill, do we? Okay. Anybody else who wants to be heard?
No.
Okay. So it appears we have some amendments to see about, and we'll hopefully get back to this bill shortly.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2657 and open public hearings on House Bill 2284 and 2285.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bills are very similar with the exception of loans in House Bill 2284 and grants in House Bill 2285. I'll just read one. House Bill 2284 requires Oregon Business Development Department to establish and administer Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program to make loans to qualified project sponsors for development of certified state and regionally significant industrial lands, allows department to forgive portions of loans where project sponsor contracts with eligible employer, limits loan forgiveness to lesser a percentage of eligible site preparation costs or estimated incremental income tax revenues, establishes Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program Fund, continuously appropriates money to the Fund of Oregon Business Development, takes effect 91st day following adjournment to sign and die.
Thank you. I had the chance to be involved with a number of folks in developing these concepts, and I think we'd like to hear from them. So Tom Gallagher, Sean Jillians, and Dan Eisenbeis. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing PBA, and PBA has taken up this bill on behalf of the Oregon Business Council and their Oregon Business Plan, so that's why we're here. In my earlier life, I was a teaching assistant, and I had four classes in one day, and the last class was at 3 o'clock, and I realized that at 3 o'clock, the attention span was about 32% of the classes at 8 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, can Representative Cameron, you're going to interrupt the teaching assistant?
I am.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. PBA, is that the Professional Bowlers Association?
I think it's the Bull Riding Association.
I was curious because it is 3 o'clock on a nice day.
No problem.
And my 4 o'clock class was slower than the other classes. Portland Business Alliance, and I'm sorry I didn't spell that out.
It was the Salem guy who didn't know about it. It's okay.
Another country.
Yes.
You asked us to give some background on this bill, and in given the time and so forth, I will take probably more time than the others as they chime in, but we'll try to do some background here. I've been involved in working on industrial lands now for 20-some years, and when we originally started it, we were trying to take a look at the properties as they were inside the land use planning system that could not be developed. And we were arguing that those properties shouldn't be on the rolls, they shouldn't be counted as industrial land, and we should probably get outside of the urban growth boundary and find more appropriate sites that could be developed to attract business. For 17 of those years, we failed. We were unable to quite break through the complications of the land use planning process. So here we are now. We have had some successes over that time. but I want to leave you with three thoughts at the beginning. There's really no common definition of what is industrial land. We've talked about traded sector. We've talked about above average wage jobs in different places. And anybody like myself and Representative Doherty that's been on a planning commission knows that this is a complicated subject. And some communities are not going to have heavy industry. Some communities are going to have light industry, et cetera. Secondly, when you do the urban growth boundary planning, there's no requirement that you have a certain number of sites of certain sizes to attract the type of business that you think you may need in your community. There's something called an economic analysis assessment or an economic analysis study that's done, which, and it's based on employment, basically, and the types of employment you might get in your community. So industrial will vary from community to community, and it's something we have to keep in mind. The third thing is that in the land use process, a piece of ground is just that, a piece of ground. It's not valued for how developable it is or what type of development should go there. It's sort of a very large a general analysis. And I know when they did the last urban growth boundary in Portland and they added all the property on the Clackamas County, most of that was basically unsuitable for industrial development, and that was not part of the analysis. So we do kind of get caught up in this process. I'm going to be followed by John Charles, who's going to say a great deal of things about this bill that I agree with as to why we don't really need it and why I'm just playing inside the process. But after 20 years, I'm at the point where we've come back and we've said, let's take a look at those sites that are already inside the urban growth boundary, that are already zoned industrial, and let's see how we can make them marketable and productive inside of the economy. So I will say that in over the last few years, we've had some successes. If you look at the governor's office and OECDD, they have been able to cite a number of large projects, especially in Washington County, that have been tremendously valuable, whether it's Intel or Boeing or companies like that that have really been helpful to our economy. So we're not totally stagnant. There are things that do move. We've also come up with the concept of shovel-ready, and shovel-ready was kind of a breakthrough translating down from this big land use analysis to say, can that plot of ground actually be marketed and sold and developed within a reasonable period of time? OECDD has come up with the idea of certified sites, where property owners can bring their sites forward, they can do an analysis, they can put them on the market, and they can go out and use those sites as they're selling to companies outside of Oregon and even companies inside of Oregon. Now, where we have identified some of the real problems inside the UGB for some of these sites is basically the local government doesn't have the fund to develop these sites to get them shovel-ready. And the bill will talk about things like transportation, infrastructure, funding for sewer, water, et cetera. And the other problem that you will have and you'll hear about from people as they come up is that these sites are owned by somebody. They're owned by a party. And we're talking about having a public investment in a piece of property that's owned by a private individual. And to some extent, that private individual may or may not gain a windfall from this public investment. That's something I think that this committee and people as we move forward on this have to talk about. I'm not sure how to solve that problem, because that problem arises because those sites are so difficult and expensive to develop. So assume there are brownfield, for example, that the private developers are not going to develop them. But they sit inside there as sites that we are supposed to market, and they're counted inside the urban growth boundary. So that brings us to the bill you have in front of you, which is not a shell, but it's a framework, a starting framework. And what I want to do now is not exactly go through all the details of the bill, but raise for you the problems that we still have to work with in working out this bill. We need to define a screen for which pieces of property we're going to have the public invest in if we use the process in this bill. So how do we make sure that we're getting the right pieces of property? And we have a couple of ideas on that. They're called regionally significant industrial sites, which we'd have to define inside of the bill. We haven't done that yet. We can look at some other definitions that exist. We can use something like the metro designation of regionally significant sites. So we have some tools. We haven't worked them in the bill yet. We think we need a new section of this bill, because this bill basically talks about loans. In this legislative session, there is going to be no money to put into a bond fund to create a pool of money that could make these loans to local government. So the loan section we'd like to leave in the bill as a framework going forward, and if at some point in time it becomes possible to develop a fund to help people, to local governments to borrow from, that would be there for them to be available, a pot that could be filled later on. We need to add another piece to the bill then. Given the fact that there's not money to start that with, there are some jurisdictions that do have the money to go forward on this. And why would they make this investment? Because when they go out and they develop a piece of property and it gets eventually sold to a development that occurs on the property, that will begin to generate money. It will give some property tax back to the local jurisdiction, but under Oregon laws, what it will generally result in is income tax, both taxes from the business and taxes from the individuals that work there. So the concept of gain share, which is used in other places and which I'm going to call tax savings, is to say, and this is a piece that's not developed yet, if the local government goes out and puts $10 million in this site of ground and it becomes developed and a company is there producing income, that there would be an agreement, and it's in Section 4 of this bill, with the state that local jurisdiction would get their investment repaid from half of the income tax that's generated from that property. So there would be no income but for the development. And when the development occurs, the state would get half and the local jurisdiction would get half back until their investment was repaid. They then could invest someplace else. But essentially, the repayment of that investment is coming from the wealth created by that development. It is coming from the development itself. There's other pieces of the bill that we're going to work on. People will talk about them. I will just cover them quickly. What size sites? We could say 25 acres. We could drop it to 10 acres. We could drop out the size altogether and say if we use the proper screen of regionally significant or so forth, we don't need to worry about the size of the site. Could be 3 acres in Tualatin because that's what they have. There another thing is that is going to be controversial, and we understand that, and it's complicated, and there are two sides to it, is in Section 3, 6D, which talks about natural resource mitigation. Our intention there was really to talk about wetlands, which most of this property, especially in Washington County that we're talking about, has significant wetlands on it. That wetlands has not been studied, it's not been delineated, etc. So the question that will come back to this committee as you move forward on the bill, if the local jurisdiction goes forward to fund parts of this analysis under this section, should they take a look at the wetlands and designate it? And then if they delineate the wetlands, should they actually begin to do some mitigation on it, which would really be a benefit to the property owner? But that's a public policy question. So we're highlighting here some of the questions I think that other people will come up and talk about. We're very aware of them. We think that they deserve a full discussion here, and we haven't come to our minds here what the conclusion is on that. And we can get, when we get on to some of those details of those, we get into some very specifics. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues, and then if there's questions, maybe you can do them in the whole panel.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Economic Development Association, in support of these two concepts. And at the outset, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you for your leadership as we've worked on these for the last 6 months at least, and obviously even dating back to Senate Bill 766 and all the work that we put in there. I think this is kind of the next extension of our work on industrial lands that came out of that discussion in Senate Bill 766. So as not to be duplicitous, I won't talk too much about 2284, and I'll focus more on the due diligence grants in 2285. I think you all had an excellent presentation by Bernie Bottomley from Portland Business Alliance as far as the study they were able to do in the area, and it was funded by Business Oregon, Port of Portland, Metro, NAOP, and PBA. Unfortunately, in other areas of the state, the resources aren't there to do those sort of studies to kind of narrow in on what sites are actually available. In that site, or in that analysis, they looked at 56 potential sites and actually narrowed it down to 9 that were truly shovel-ready. We felt that was very beneficial, and then they were able to glean out what obstacles might be there for potential development of those sites. As I mentioned, other areas of the state don't have the same level of resources to be able to do that analysis. So,
Mr. Billings, it might be worth saying just that I think we heard that presentation before this session began in the interim.
Yeah.
So a number of the committee members did hear it, but some did not. And just to keep that in mind as you're going forward. Thank you.
And that'd probably be good to get you guys a copy of that study, too, because I think it's very informative as to the sort of thing that we would envision with this grant program for other areas of the state to be able to do. So we'll be sure to do that, Mr. Chair. And as the bill is structured, it would provide small grants to local economic development agencies or local governments to be able to conduct their own studies to look at what lands are inside what lands, not wetlands, what lands are inside the urban growth boundary that might be suitable for these potential projects. We feel this would be beneficial not only to the local communities, but obviously the state general fund in the end if we're able to bring in large industrial employers. So those are kind of the thoughts. I think Mr. Gallagher did a good job of describing that they are very much a work in progress, and we appreciate your leadership and Senator Byers as we kind of move forward on amendments and flesh these bills out.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eisenbeiss.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. Also want to acknowledge your leadership, Mr. Chair, and Senator Byers' leadership in helping to formulate these concepts. We are very much in support of both of the concepts before you today. I think Mr. Gallagher did a very good job of describing some of the issues that still need to be worked through. From the City of Portland's perspective, for instance, we have an interest in this framework in 2284 not being restricted solely to sites that are over 25 acres. We have seen that the overwhelming share of demand for development in industrial areas is actually on sites of less than 20 acres, and the job density tends to be higher on some of those sites that are under that threshold. But there are ways to establish a filter to limit the application of this to truly valuable sites. So just want to thank my colleagues for their work in helping to formulate this and study the issues that are involved and register the City of Portland support for the general concept. At the heart of this, I think, really boils down to a framework that would offer the opportunity for the state and local project sponsors to partner to make strategic investments to get these sites moved toward development, because both local communities and the state really reap the benefits, the community benefits, and the state very much so reaps direct tax benefits.
Thank you. And before we take questions, I would just note for the record that we have posted our meeting on Monday also for the general purpose of land use, so these bills can carry over to that day if we have further discussion. Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Lively.
So I have a lot of questions, but I won't go through all of them at this particular moment because what you've told me is kind of a work in progress. And so, but let me just express some of my, I guess, questions or concerns. And first, I'll just disclose I'm a very good friend of Senator Byers, but that doesn't mean we always go right down the same path. We've discussed this going back and forth. So just for the record, so my concerns go back to the expenditure of public funds and where those funds. I have no problem with public infrastructure, and I think that's appropriate, but some of the things in this bill talks about things that aren't, from my standpoint, public infrastructure, and would indeed be more directly in the short term, especially, and even in the long term, the benefit to the property owner. And so how do we, and I understand the provisions that there could be taxes in that, but how do we ensure that the public interest is protected? One of the things it talks about in here is even the idea of acquisition of land. So I read several provisions here, planning and engineering. All of those things are concerns to me when we go talking about using public funds, because that is what the development community is supposed to do with the site. So I guess, I don't know if those are things that are going to be further clarified or what's going to happen with those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, I think I agree with you. I agree that those are issues. we are now investigating and having, and you, I know from your background on local government, you know that there are a number of relationships between the person who wants to develop the property and the city. There are tax issues, there are agreements, there are LIDs, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things are still in place.
Okay.
So the one thing that I think that we'd put in your mind as you think through these things is many of these sites have a passive developer in this sense.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's a brownfield, and starting to turn soil on the brownfield for a company that may or may not be even situated in Oregon anymore is better just let it sit there. But it's still counted as developable industrial land. So what we don't, we do recognize and are not sure how to deal with is a huge beneficial windfall to the property developer from public investment into that piece of property. Now, we're talking with other folks back there as to whether that can be done by agreement between the local government and the developer,
mm-hmm.
Whether or not we should look at having some requirements but for that money to be repaid. That's also been on the table. And what I would say there is that there are, in my experience, there are three pieces to this. And from sitting on a planning commission in that sense, there's usually the property owner who often changes the zoning or the comp plan and then gives it over to a developer who goes out to find somebody who's actually going to use the property. And it's really not till you get to that third party that you actually bring any dollars to the table. So it's trying to close the gap between having a product that's for sale that the actual applicant can look at and say, yes, I can use that, and how we match up the public investment with those two intervening parties or three intervening parties to what benefit do they get from that. I think that you really put your finger on what we need to work with. The last thing I would leave with you is to say is most of this comes about because of an indirectly because of the land use system. In the past, those pieces of property we just never would have been counted, never would have developed. They just sat there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine because somebody would have gone somewhere else and built somewhere else and the community would have that development. We're kind of stuck 20 years after the urban growth boundaries moved, and we need to bring those properties into play. We're sensitive to that.
And I agree, and I understand. I worked in economic development for years, and one of my frustrations were those sites that you talked about, adding to the owners. The other issue then becomes, as we're talking about doing this, is how it applies across the state, because what might work in Portland, or does work in Portland, or even Eugene Springfield, may not work in Eastern Oregon places, but the idea is the same. I mean, they need to have a site or something that's ready to go in many cases, and I understand it may sit there longer. But the bottom line is development happens because there's something that can take place within a certain amount of time. And so I don't know whether there'd be provisions in this that talks about the ability to do something different if it only applies to a large city user.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, I think our intent certainly is to keep it flexible enough. I think the key thing to stress in this is permissive sort of language that a local government, we want to allow them to have some flexibility in how they administer this program and what they would expend up front versus recover and back. And so I think keeping some degree of flexibility in there while, of course, having safeguards will get to both of your questions in this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may add to that, I think, again, you hit on an issue. We have a tendency sometimes to take whatever public money there is and divide it up into equal shares. Transportation is a good example of that. So, you know, that works pretty well sometimes. It doesn't work very well the other. In my view, we're now reaching a level of regulation and complication, so we have to rethink some of these without depriving a local jurisdiction of what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a concept that the LCDC dealt with for a while, and they kind of discarded it. It still is something to keep a hand on. It's called bird in the hand,
mm-hmm.
which there's a difference between when you're trying to get a piece of property ready to really get out on the market and when you've got somebody here who wants to go at it. And what we have sometimes on the bird in the hand is the land use process is more lengthy, and the bird flies away before you get done. Well, we can't always make all this public investment and have all of these sites sitting out there ready to go waiting for the bird. If you have some good thoughts on that, please share them with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The representative from Springfield, I almost called you mayor because of your great experience serving in several capacities.
That's one of those titles you get to keep for a while, though, right? So we could still call him mayor?
Maybe. I want to recognize your long experience in public service and serving as mayor as well as economic development professionally. I come at this a little bit differently, having served on a planning commission and city council, but not the professional expertise that some of you on the committee have. There are three things that I started wondering listening to your presentation. First of all, about studies. We need, you know, studies to know what's developable. And, well, studies get old fast. It seems like within a year after a study's done, it's stale and its usefulness diminishes rapidly. So do we want to encourage studies really? You know, it seems like this is related a little bit to a conversation we had about the Columbia River crossing. I know we're supposed to call it the I-5 bridge, but we actually have what had been called the I-5 bridge project down in Springfield, Eugene. On CRC, we've heard an awful lot about investment grade analysis, and you can't do that too long before a project because the data isn't going to be found to be worthy and reliable. So I want to hear a little bit about studies. And, well, yeah, some places studies have been done, but what does it mean? Someone's going to say, this is no longer valid. That's the first question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I think you raise a good point, of course, with how valid and the length of time that a study would be beneficial. I think, though, in our unique land use system, where our supply is constrained and you're dealing with a finite by and large, and especially in your city, because apparently the UGB is never going to move, you truly are dealing with a finite amount of land. And a lot of the issues, the transportation issues, the wetlands issues, are long term. They are things that would still be relevant even if you went and did a delineation, let's say, on wetlands. Those are typically now under new statutes good for at least 5 years. So I think there is a real benefit. And obviously, the way that we had discussed this to make sure that it's not just the state throwing money out there, and it's, I'm not sure it's actually in the bill yet, is to require the local entities to have some skin in the game as well. We certainly didn't anticipate that this was just going to be a windfall from the state, and everyone's going to run out and do their studies on land that's never going to be developed. So I think certainly we're receptive to that argument, and that was kind of the path that we had gone down in our discussions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, again, another long-term conundrum here. There are certain sites, certain characteristics of sites we've developed over the year for industrial, for larger scale, that are pretty clear. And one reason to use a filter is to kind of stop local governments from putting up all sorts of sites that may or may not, in their view, may be very successful, but in the market view, may not be too successful. So one part of the study is to facilitate that filter or make that filter work. The second part is that there's going to be a limited amount of money. There never is enough. And so if there's not some kind of a funnel in which we use to invest this public money, we may not achieve any goals at all. So I don't think this is a study bill. I think what we talked about in another is an assessment bill. And if you saw the original presentation, what they did was they went out and took all the pieces of property and assessed whether or not they were the right pieces, what it would take to get them up to shovel ready. And that's very specific. That takes place right now. We did it a number of years ago in a bill here where the legislature said we wanted 20 statewide sites shovel ready. And I can't remember when we did that bill, maybe 8 to 10 years ago. And what we learned from that is they wanted 6 months to get them shovel ready. There was not a single one of these head of the pack sites were ready in 6 months. So we did learn from all of those assessments and studies.
Okay. And one follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. Another thing that interests me in this discussion, and I don't know whether it factors into who pays, who benefits, who's compensated. Sometimes the type of activity that we're trying to attract is so large that there's actually a very significant secondary market that's going to benefit. For example, when Hynix located in West Eugene, there was a discussion about how many jobs and how much economic activity existed because of all the suppliers, daily suppliers of services to that huge facility. So how do we figure out what not only that particular property owner, but other existing or potential new businesses, what's their role in this, and what's their part of the game? Because if that piece is successful, there's going to be a lot of other benefit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I think the first thing I would say is I hope we have that problem. I hope that we're successful enough that we draw in another Intel that has that supply sort of chain that has helped, you know, Washington County immensely. So I think when you're looking at overall what parcels are available, you're going to be looking at the infrastructure and what else could be near. I'd love to have that problem. Dan?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, certainly that is a good problem to face. I think it speaks to why local communities and the state, for that matter, are willing to make investments in economic development activities, because there is a larger benefit to the community. In the case of this concept before you, House Bill 2284, I think part of the genesis is recognition that the expenses that are involved in this kind of activity in many cases far exceed the financial capacity of local communities, and that the state it receives many of those direct benefits with income tax revenue, and there might be an opportunity to forge stronger partnerships.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on that, is it a situation where we have created so many layers of compliance that we have to now pay to try to get through them? Isn't that what's really going on? Because when you look at the list of stuff here, we've created most of it. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's as though we have so many protections built into the system, and we want them for the most part because they make everything in some fashion better. But we've almost priced ourselves out of it by virtue of wanting all of those accoutrements of development.
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, I can tell you that when I speak with my colleagues at the City of Portland, the kinds of costs that they identify as being challenges as in the City of Portland are things like the cost of infrastructure for sites or the cost of brownfields remediation for redevelopment of sites. Those are in some cases hard costs, and in other cases they're costs that are related to the characteristics of the site, and they are not necessarily reflective of regulation per se.
Thank you for that. That may well be because the City of Portland has a staff of planners. I don't want to ask how many, and a team of engineers and a team of lawyers and a whole bunch of teams. If we go out to our small communities, we don't have any of those teams. And so the other day, a gentleman in Ontario wanted to put in a small development, but he was told he needed a $10,000 study to see if he complied with the TPR. He didn't have $10,000, and so. And there's no one there to readily help. So what ends up happening is he contacts the state, and the poor state is then stuck with trying to figure out how to help him out. And so this process, I really appreciate this bill. It's going to vary from location to location as to how one would spend the grant money, but it's absolutely essential that we figure out a way of managing the challenges from just the planning standpoint in these smaller communities. And we don't even get to the infrastructure. We can't, because there's too much paper shuffling to get there. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying we can't get there from here. And so this bill gives us at least a opportunity to take this one step further. We just added, we hope, some acres to the Ontario within the urban growth boundary, $100,000 in planning. That meant they probably will have to close a swimming pool. Okay, so, I mean, that's how it works in these little bitty towns. So to the extent that we can make this work for those places, I think it's a good thing. But it's a commentary on a whole bunch of other things, and not just the cost of a sewer line. And not saying it's bad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, my friend John Charles will come up and talk about this in a very revolutionary way, almost bomb-throwing, et cetera, et cetera. We should pay more attention sometimes to this voice, because there will be other voices on the other side. I really think we're getting to the point where we need to adjust and relearn how to regulate to protect those public goods that we originally started, because we are layering and layering and layering on top of a structure that can no longer carry it. And we keep coming back and saying back, we need to get to the rich guy, we need to get to the property owner, we need to make people pay their fair share. This is still a community. And smaller communities and larger communities, both of them have the same problem. Now, I don't have an answer for that, but as you guys move forward to, I'm almost done, as you guys move forward to, you're going to have to take this next round of regulation on.
That's a stark way to stop. Appreciate it. Representative Cameron?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I think the 4 o'clock class bell just rang. I wanted to follow up on Representative Bence's point. At least the bill does have that point in it on line number 14. Public assistance is necessary to overcome development-related constraints caused by poor public policy and to incentivize industrial site development in the state. The poor public policy isn't in there.
Yeah, I didn't.
I don't remember that part.
Harrison was slipping in more language.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Next up, Mark Landau, Randy Tucker. And John, after that preview, you're on deck.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Yes, 4:04 p.m. Friday. So I'll try to keep it brief. Try is the operative term there. Randy Tucker, Metro's Legislative Affairs Manager. First of all, Mr. Chair, you mentioned that there have been some previous presentations in various committees on the work that led up to this legislation, and Metro was very happy to be a partner in the development of sort of the concept as we came forward, and it was based on a study that was a partnership between Metro, the Portland Business Alliance, NAOP, the National Association of Industrial and Office Parks, Business Oregon, and the Port of Portland. And it's a great partnership of people that have different people, organizations that have different missions, different priorities and imperatives, but came together around this effort to identify and sort of articulate a problem that we all agreed needed to be solved. And in my mind, that problem was land that is already industrial land, already either in an urban growth boundary, or in the case of the study that we conducted, there were a couple of sites, I believe, that might have been right outside the urban growth boundary, but in urban reserves in the metropolitan region, the Portland metropolitan region. So it really wasn't about land use so much. It was about how do we make the land we have ready. That's Metro's interest. There is land. It's not available in the short term for development because it has a variety of constraints. So our interest is in using the land we have efficiently and creating and attracting traded sector jobs to that land that bring prosperity into the Portland metropolitan region. And obviously this bill has a statewide application, and so I would say that that's true, that statewide, though of course I represent just one part of the state. We're interested in helping local jurisdictions achieve their economic development goals. These are goals they've already articulated to bring jobs to land they already have. And again, not just in the metro area, but statewide. So with that, I'd just like to say, I mean, obviously we're still working on this bill. It's a work in progress. We're supporting the concept as it moves forward and hoping to get to something that will not only be legislatively workable, but also workable on the ground and actually provide resources over time to local communities, especially that are struggling to make sites ready because of the costs associated with infrastructure, with site aggregation, with brownfields remediation, with wetland delineation and other constraints. So I'll just stop there and thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Landauer.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association. There are 23 public ports in the state of Oregon, and we are here very much in support of the concepts behind House Bills 2284 and 85. As Mr. Gallagher mentioned previously, all communities in the state of Oregon are not the same, and ports across the state vary in different sizes and their primary functions. However, one of the core functions, of course, is economic development, port support, many existing jobs in the state of Oregon, and our incubators of creating new jobs. One of the concerns that our memberships have had, at least with the original draft of the bill, was the size limitations, and we are working with the folks who are shepherding these bills along to ensure that as many ports will be able to at least knock on the door, if you will, for this process to be eligible to conduct these types of due diligence work. I would like to also emphasize that we as a state are in a regional as well as national, international competition to attracting employers. And one of the key elements to that competition, as some of my colleagues have mentioned, is land readiness. If we don't have land ready for developers or companies to actually site and build, we are at a disadvantage. And therefore, one of the key components is to make this land ready for construction and employment, and that's really the key element that we need to all remember in the discussion here. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Representative Davis.
Sorry about that. I have a question.
We do have a question for
thank you, Chair, for the port. Can you talk about maybe some examples of what we have to compete with state by state in terms of these sorts of economic development programs? And
well,
I imagine with your position at the ports, you might see that.
Certainly. Ports have a few tools available to them, one of them being enterprise zones, for example, where property taxes can be abated for attracting companies, and those programs certainly are effective and have been used in several ports, cities, counties, so on and so forth. But the availability of land for many of our ports, Coos Bay might be a good example, where there is a lot of former industrial land that is currently not usable for a variety of reasons. This type of legislation, the state partnering with the port itself, may make that land far more attractive. Ports regularly have interested companies kicking tires. The problem is oftentimes, though, that those ports or that land is not ready to go. They don't have the proper infrastructure or brownfield mitigation, things of that nature. If those lands were ready to go, they would be in a far better position to say, go get your building permits, we're ready to go. And that's what we're trying to get to. Get you to the building official's office, pull the permits, and let's turn dirt today. So there are some tools, but this would be another tool in that box, if you will, to get us to that point where we can actually say it's ready to go and we're open for business.
Thanks.
Thank you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, John Charles, Jody Weiser, Peggy Woolsey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles with Cascade Policy Institute. And I didn't know when I had a random five-minute conversation with Mr. Gallagher right before this hearing that it would turn him into my marketing agent, but...
you didn't come to an agreement on that, or royalties
or anything?
Okay.
I'd actually like to turn the conversation a little bit back to a comment he made in his testimony regarding the 17-year odyssey he and his clients went on in search of yes in the regulatory system, which is mostly the land use regulatory system, and how at the end of the odyssey they still couldn't find land, they couldn't get to yes. And it kind of indicates to me, well, it's not for lack of money or good intentions. They have good intentions, and I believe his clients have enough money to be quite adequately represented by top lawyers, economists, planners, and of course, excellent lobbyists. Well, I'm sure that's self-evident. And they couldn't get to yes. So I think it's time to say that money and good intentions are not enough. And this bill is another go-round of good intentions and both private and public money. But it's skirting the problem of our dysfunctional 40-year wandering in the woods with the nation's most punitive land use regulatory system. We have massive downzoning throughout the state that makes it illegal to do anything profitable in most lands. And we have an urban land cartel created and administered by a government, which is great if you have land in the right place at the right time. The cartel is good for you. You can make have it go at 10, 20 times its market value, but it's bad for everybody else. And in other unregulated sectors, such as telecommunications, computing, the market is dynamic. We don't see shortages. We see tons of innovation and declining prices, and consumers love it. And we don't get any of that in the land use arena, where we're stuck with a vision that some legislators had 40 years ago. This is not just my view. I was at a conference last year where Richard Whitman, formerly head of DLCD and the governor's top natural resource advisor, said, and he was speaking very slowly, and I wrote it all down, our current Oregon land use system is not sustainable in its current form. It needs to be better, cheaper, and faster. Again, he's well-intentioned. He believes in it. He used to administer it. It's not working. And there's a spillover problem, which is that having lots of land, lots of cheap land, serviceable land, really isn't very good if it's landlocked because there are no roads to it, and especially no highways. Well, it's been 31 years since we opened a major highway in this state. And when I talk to people who make a living in this business of commercial real estate and sell, marketing whatever industrial land they can get, they make it pretty clear to me that their clients or prospective clients want to be near something like I-84, Highway 26 on the west side, 217, I-5. They don't want to be in some podunk little section of streets, a labyrinth of streets that they can't get trucks in and out of. Well, because the land use planners and their patrons have a death grip on the political system in the state, we don't build highways at all. We don't build multiple bridges over big rivers, except a new bridge over the Willamette that excludes trucks and cars being built right now. So if you can't build roads, then you have a lot of land that's landlocked that can't be used for these purposes. And this is all because, new roads and new bridges supposedly would encourage sprawl. We can't have that, so we're stuck with the system that we have. So my simple conclusion is that, you could try this and spin some wheels more, but you really have to confront the fact that this is the 40th anniversary of our state's system, and there will be lots of backslapping and congratulatory parties, and I went to one of them recently where I was a speaker, and there are people from all around the world, and they're talking about the great Oregon system. And I think it's time to say we tried it, it was well-intended, it didn't work, and let's move on. Otherwise, we're going to have these same conversations over and over and over and have more expensive Band-Aids, and rational people are just going to leave or do business elsewhere and never even come. And it's a shame, because in a state that is roughly 2% urbanized and 98% open space, the notion that we should have a shortage of any kind of land is absurd. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Who's next?
For the record, I'm Jody Wisey with Facts Fairness Oregon, and Peggy and I are kind of splitting this so that you won't have to listen to either one of us for too long. So I live in Washington County, and I went to an open house, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, and looked at a map with 500 acres with an overlay of this is going to be industrial land. And that land is served by two interchanges. One of them's just now being built for $43 million. And since it's actually costing less than that, the excess money is being put into the surface streets that would get people in and out, you know, use those interchanges well. So what I have seen when I'm bike riding around my own county is land that's prepared that sits vacant. I've been picking berries at the same place for 5 years because there's a nice street, nice sidewalk, trees planted in the strip, and there's no traffic there, so I don't have to worry about what's you know, gotten on the berries. They're pretty clean. The land is available. What's difficult, I think, is that banks don't loan to develop land because they don't know how long it's going to sit there like this property in Washington County. When I called a friend who's a commercial developer the other night, because his name happened to be on that land, he said, well, actually, it's pretty interesting that my client, I'm guessing it's Westmark, which is a developer that does big, you know, areas of land. They have the money to go in and do it themselves. Got the land ready, sold it for about $8 a square foot. The party that they sold it to did not end up succeeding as a business, and so they got it back when it was in bankruptcy for $2 a square foot, and it's now being marketed for $8 a square foot again. So what concerns me is that in Washington County, what we're going to see is people who bought their land and were farming it, and they probably paid what my family did, someplace between $300 and $3,000 an acre for the land. It's now going to be worth $200,000 an acre because it's inside the urban growth boundary, and it's zoned industrial. And they will wish it were zoned for residential because it would be worth $400,000 an acre that way. And so they'll try to do what that first bill was attempting to address. Don't change the zoning so you get more money out of it, because we need the places for the people to work to be near where they live. And there's both of those elements in that area. So 2285 is about studies. And one piece is that kind of how do we prioritize? And if I think of Washington County, you know, where are the roads already there? Where is the water nearby? Not necessarily where is the landscape such that there won't be issues with water you have to deal with, because we live in a wet place. There's always going to be issues to have to deal with. What are we doing about the water when we make a soft surface into a hard surface? So it is fixing the priorities about where we'll develop, and that makes sense. It seems like a public function. We already give away grants from the Department of Transportation and hunks of $100,000 to communities to do the kind of planning for that kind of infrastructure. And it actually worries me that the way that bill is currently written, there are too many different organizations, individuals, and entities that could all want to do these $50,000 studies. And it would make better sense if we got a larger entity looking at what's the next step to go. Because, of course, otherwise we already heard in this building, Gresham fighting against Washington County for what's going to be next. And that really seems like a public function, that kind of overview planning. But the next part of it, okay, I've got this piece of property, and I've got to figure out whether there's any, if one of the ranchers before me had a gas tank, and so I've got an EPA problem, or whether somebody was doing chroming on the property, because I heard that. That is the property owner's problem. They bought it for a price that included those risks, or they actually were the family that created the risks. They knew what they were, what they know what they have, and it doesn't make sense for the public to pay for that investigation. But it does make sense for the public to say, we'll loan you money so you can do that investigation. And the bank's not going to be eager to do it. They don't want to do it unless you have, you have a nice stock portfolio so it's clear how you'll pay the loan back, or you have a bunch of other land that you're making profit off of. You've got to have some other source of income because they don't know how long it's going to be. What's missing in the bill is a lot of the details. When you loan money, do you want it to be risk-adjusted or do you want it to be just above your cost? Do you want to say these are going to be loans where you have to start paying tomorrow? Or do you want to say these are going to be balloon loans? And those are really policy decisions that you guys should be making, not Business Oregon making, because you don't know what's happening otherwise. So that's kind of that 2285 part of the bill.
Thank you, Julie.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. My area of expertise is really taxes, and this is not in my area of expertise, but I'm lucky to have my own private finance, commercial finance advisor. So I called my daughter, who works for Umpqua Bank. She is a manager in charge of commercial loan analysts who support the work of the commercial loan officers. She said that banks are generally not anxious to make this kind of loan. They have been known to make them. They usually, if the property is worth $1 million, they'll usually only make the loan for maybe up to $500,000. She said the loan origination fee is usually going to be about 1%. She wasn't sure of the current loan rate. She says the Fed has the rates artificially low right now, So the banks are low, but they have to be competitive with the other banks. So it's going to be pretty much the same across from one bank to another on the interest rate. She did say that this would fill a need for a lot of industrial property owners to be able to start the process. If they can't get a loan through a bank, it would be nice if they could fall back on the state. I would like to suggest some amendments. Generally speaking, I would like to see this not be a forgivable loan. It's hard for me to swallow forgivable loans when all the public service budgets have to go begging and the cuts are so deep. I would recommend an amendment that could say that the interest rate will be so many percentage points above the state's cost or below the bank loan rate if you want to make it a lower interest loan than a bank would grant. I would like to also have you specify whether this is going to be a balloon loan payment that will be due when the property is sold, or whether the applicants would have to start payments right away. I would like something in the amendment that would specify the loan origination fees, title, filing costs, etc. And I would like to see an amendment that addresses the option for a business owner who already owns property that he intends to maybe develop. That doesn't seem to me to be as desirable as helping out the property owner who wants to get that property ready for marketing to somebody who's going to develop it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Let's see. Thank you very much. We have two more people to hear from, Brittany Weinberg and Alma Flores. And we we saved the striped the stripes for the last pair. Ms. Weinberg, if you'd like to start, we'd be glad to hear from you.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gorsuch, and the committee. I'm Jody Weiser's intern. This is my first time speaking to you guys, so thank
and,
you.
And we need you to start with your name, too, please.
Oh, yes, I'm Brittany Weinberg.
Thank
sorry.
You.
Thank
problem.
You. So I have a feeling that the people owning the land right now... excuse me.
Take your time. You're fine.
Take your time.
You're fine.
Okay, so the people owning the land right now, I have a feeling they aren't of my generation, and my generation are going to be the ones paying the money back. So, thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Of course.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I will speak to both bills as our message is the same. My name is Alma Flores, and I serve as the City of Beaverton's Economic Development Manager, and I have had the pleasure of working with Chair Reed on developing economic development tools in the city to encourage job creation. I want to just mention that my main role at the city is to ensure that existing and potentially new businesses have the land, labor, infrastructure, and capital or tools they need to locate and expand in Beaverton. For those of you on the committee who are not familiar with the city, Beaverton is a landlocked first-tier suburb west of Portland with a burgeoning population of over 91,000 coming from varying social and economic backgrounds. We are blessed with a strategic location, strategic and,
push it away a little bit. It'll distort a little less. There you go.
Strategic and competitive location within the region as part of what has been coined the Silicon Forest. We benefit from a highly educated workforce, an established and mature infrastructure, a strong and growing set of small and medium-sized businesses, and new economic development tools such as the Enterprise Zone. We believe that House Bill 2284 and 2285 are important new tools to make Oregon competitive regionally, nationally, and globally. However, in their current form, the tools these bills offer are out of our reach. In short, what the city lacks is a good supply of shovel-ready large lots, as defined in House Bill 2284 and 2285. We, however, feel that it is important for the state to expand and provide tools and resources to communities that face different challenges and have a different set of constraints. I want to briefly state what our current land constraints are. Currently, the city of Beaverton has only 44 industrially zoned vacant parcels and only 46 redevelopable industrially zoned land, a total of just over 90 parcels. And of those 90 industrially zoned parcels, 46 of them are contaminated, making the due diligence tool as valuable as the loan. Of those vacant and redevelopable industrial lands, or parcels, 71 are over 5 acres, just one is larger than 10 acres, and none are 25 acres or larger. The city of Beaverton is eager to bring more industrial development to Oregon, but we need access to the right tools to do it. Mature urban communities like Beaverton have already invested in infrastructure and have close access to ports, highly educated workers, and freight routes. We respectfully request that the threshold under House Bill 2284 and 2285 be lowered to 5 acres to reflect more mature urban areas with existing infrastructure and direct access to a growing and highly skilled workforce. We recognize that resources are scarce and need to be focused on the greatest impact, but that may not be simply determined by the largest industrially zoned sites. We urge the committee to amend both these bills to reduce the urban acre threshold to 5 acres while emphasizing the competitive nature of the forgivable loan and grants as measured in jobs created and salary levels. We would also support a limit on the overall number of sites funded to provide a degree of certainty on the overall fiscal impact. With that, I am done, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? No questions. We appreciate it. And Brittany, before you leave, I understand this is probably your first time testifying, but I hope it will not be your last. I imagine you have lots to say. We appreciate you being here and being part of the discussion. Yeah. And you too, Ms. Flores.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Seems clear that we have some amendments to make to these bills if they are to go forward. That completes the list of people who signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who wants to hear? I don't see you on the list, but if you'd like to come forward, that's fine.
I did sign up for 2285.
My name is...
You're right. We missed... we were looking at 2284 and missed that sheet. My apologies. Please go ahead.
All right. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Patrick Story with Tax Fairness Oregon, and I want to make a brief statement on real estate markets. For several years before the collapse of the Wall Street banks in 2007, I was a licensed real estate agent in Portland. I saw many transactions involving the lovely old houses in Portland neighborhoods, many of them 75 or 100 years older or more. In those years, there was understandably a thriving renovation industry in Portland, and according to yesterday's Oregonian, the dollar value of Portland renovation projects is now going up again. The renovations I saw were not merely interior. For example, many hundred-year-old foundations were crumbling and had to be replaced under houses put up on jacks. Such excavations cost the sellers tens of thousands of dollars, which they were able to borrow, repay on sale of the property, and still make a profit. No one selling a residence ever expected a renovation loan to be forgivable. Now, we have heard, likewise, that now, as in the pre-recession residential market, industrial lands are in demand, and there is a shortage of them. That was in the House land use hearing on the 12th of February, and we heard some of the same here at this hearing. If taxpayer loans to these sellers are justifiable, there's absolutely no reason for the state to forego repayment and transfer wealth from taxpayers to landowners just to increase their expected profits in the market. For example, we heard at this hearing that the forgiveness cost would be paid from the wealth of the site itself. Now, that seems to circle back on why the state would provide these very valuable loans, and that is in the hope that at some day in the future there would be tax revenues that would benefit Oregon taxpayers and the public schools and other concerns that we all share. And so, in light of that, there seems to be no economic justification for forgivable loans in the sale, the private sale of industrial lands. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Story? Thank you for your testimony. And unless I've missed someone else, that completes the list of people who have signed up to be heard on these bills. Anyone else who wants to be heard? Don't see any. So we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2284 to 2285. Anything else for the committee? Have a good weekend. We'll see you Monday. Committee's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.